Hi everyone. This month I have the honor and the privilege to have with me Jennifer Chimanga, formerly Baluto. Jennifer is a partner at Gifford Chance. She's also the co-head of Africa and she heads the sector group at TMT as well. Jennifer is the example of someone who has risen to heights probably unimaginable to herself or to anyone else. She is really, really an established lawyer. Very well respected in the market, and is a proud example of a Kenyan who is a success story. I really think that. Do you feel that when you come back home? Do you feel that people think, this is Jennifer? She's a legend.
Kenyan is such a patriotic lot.
Yeah, you know? But that's great.
Patriotic, and I think that's one of our key strengths as a country, so we celebrate each other.
Yeah.
And I think that's really special. We shouldn't really take it for granted because not many other countries do that, and that's one of the things that make us truly special.
Yeah. So you do feel it?
I do feel it.
I mean, we're very, very proud of you. How did you, first of all, where did you start? Tell us about yourself. Did you think that you would do law?
I did think I was going to do law.
Why?
Because my dad...
Oh, he's a lawyer.
No, he's not.
Oh.
No, he's not a lawyer. I was probably... living his dream. Both my parents were public servants and grew up, you know, at least for as long as I can remember, have good memory. I grew up on the Kenyan coast, a really, really hot place in Kilifi. As I said, my parents were public servants. My mom was a teacher. In fact, at some point, she taught me English. So if you recognize any weird accent, that's my mom. With a Gamba accent.
Well, if we got to do to London, so we're sure it can't be that bad.
No, it cannot be that bad. But every so often, I'm like, mom, I need to speak proper English. So my dad thought that I would make a good lawyer, but I think in his mind, he had in mind a litigator.
Yeah.
And that's because I was probably the trade unionist in the household. I come from a big family. There's 7 children.
Oh, wow.
In my household.
So what number are you?
Number 3.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so also, I was the one advocating for girls to wear trousers.
Yeah.
Family. I was the one advocating for chores to be distributed evenly.
Yeah.
I had a sense of fairness very early in my life. And my dad thought I would make a very good advocate of the High Court of Kenya.
Which you did. Yes. So how do you start your legal career?
So when I graduated from uni, I went to Hamilton, Harrison and Matthews. And as it was back in the day, you spent some time in litigation, then you spent some time in commercial. So I did it the other way around. I started in commercial, which went very well. I was working with Paris Shah. He was excellent. We got very well. He taught me a lot.
Yeah.
Then I went to litigation, and because for some reason Paris had sold me as this superstar, I was put under Ken Fraser, you know, God rest his soul, and I did not last a day.
Really? Yeah. Why?
Because I just think, first of all, I just don't think litigation was my thing.
Yeah.
But that's hindsight, right? Hindsight is a beautiful thing. I just got some basic instructions very wrong. He had a whole pile of correspondence and he asked me to arrange this correspondence chronologically with the latest on top. And I did it the other way around.
Oh.
And, you know, carried the pile to his desk. And when he came back from court and he saw the oldest
at the top,
he just brought the whole pile back to me.
Oh, gosh.
I asked you to arrange it with the latest on top. And I was like, oh, crap. And then said, do you really want to be? And if you want to go back to commercial.
You can.
And I was like, okay, sorry. Yeah, no, I didn't. I realized quite early on that litigation wasn't going to be my thing. I also realized, actually, that my personality, I absolutely fear conflict. And I hate conflict. And it took me a long time to realize that I actually don't like conflict situations. When I qualified, I was happy to be back in commercial.
Excellent. So you were working with Paris.
Uh-huh.
You're working on M&A transactions or corporate commercial transactions. Uh-huh. What special skill do you think you had that Paris had identified or that, you know, he knew this is a good... She's a good commercial lawyer.
I feel like that's a question for Paris. At the time, I was just trying to, like, survive.
Keep your head above
water. But, you know, there's one thing for us and Aisha is that we both have a very strong work ethic. We work extremely hard. And I just remember, you know, that he was delegating quite a lot to me from a very young age, and I would work very, very hard to get it done. And I think he liked that.
The diligence.
Yeah.
I guess it takes a lot of diligence to be a lawyer playing at the top of the game. Mm-hmm. How did you then end up in London? And I mean, I read or saw that you said that you moved to London for love.
I did.
Right. Okay. How did that come out? Did that come about? Who is the man in question?
Oh, no, I will not identify them.
Oh, he can't get it. Oh,
so it's not definitely not Chimamanda.
Oh, why not your husband? Okay.
Yeah, no, he's not my husband at the moment. No, he was a great guy, and but at the time I felt I needed to find a job in London before moving and leaving everything behind to fall in love. So even though I was head over heels in love, I still had some sense to first find, you know.
So how did the Clifford Chance opportunity come about?
That's a really good question. So as it turns out, 2 years prior to my move, so in 2009, I did ILFA.
Yeah.
So I think Samindolo also did ILFA.
Did Shem, actually.
So did Shem. Yeah. So I did ILFA in 2009, and I was on the ticket for Chance.
Okay.
And interestingly, this litigation thing always follows me. So I left for this secondment, you know, wanting to go into the other large M&A deals, etc. Because that's what I was doing back home in Kenya with Paris. And then I got there and was sent to litigation.
Oh, gosh.
And I was like, no, I'm not going to be able to survive, you know, 3 months of this. So I pushed really hard and managed to get myself into their private equity team and had about 1.5 months of doing private equity and got really good experience. So then really also established strong relationships. So when 2 years later I was looking to move to London, I had some contacts I could speak to, and as it so happens, they had impressed some people at CC.
I mean, that's, really good. I mean, it feels like everything, all the chips are falling into place slowly by slowly as you're getting to London. Mm-hmm. So when you did join Clifford Chance, were you joining in the private equity team or?
I joined in the private equity team. I mean, it's interesting they use the phrase chips falling into place. I think I was really fortunate to win the timing, because I was moving in 2011. This was just a few years after the financial crisis. And a lot of international investors were beginning to look to emerging markets for growth. And so some of our largest clients in the private equity space were beginning to ask about Africa, you know, what do you know about the African market, where are the opportunities, etc. So when I eventually got an interview with the PE partners at CC, there was lots of questions around how I see the market, how I see the landscape, you know, what investors are concerned about when doing deals, what are the risks, what are the opportunities. So I was really lucky to have been at that point.
Yeah.
At that, you know, at that point.
Well, it's opportunity meeting preparation. When people say luck, I always say that opportunity meeting preparation, because you're already prepared for the job. It's just that you didn't have it yet. So you get to London, you now have the job. You're sitting in Clifford Chance. I mean, I have been a trainee in London as well. And I know you can feel like a fish out of water, even having gone to university in London. How did you feel when you got there?
It was such a change, because I feel like the role of the lawyer has really evolved here in Kenya, even in the time I've been away. At the time, I remember distinctly that we would only negotiate legal points. As soon as you get into the P&L, as soon as you get into the balance sheet, as soon as you get into the pricing discussions, you know, our standard response to the clients were always, this is a commercial point, you need to take a call. And then I get to Clifford Chance, and I'll never forget this. You know, it was a management equity plan that was being restructured, and there were a lot of economics around how the carry sort of, you know, is calculated. And I was on a call with this partner and with a client, and the whole thing was discussed, and at the end of the call, the partner said, okay, go away and draft it. And it took me a whole day. And I remember crying because I didn't know what to write. I knew the concept, but I didn't know how to translate that, and I couldn't understand how we were expected to be converting all of that into drafting.
Yeah.
So it was a very, very big change, and it was a big change culturally as well.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't drink at the time.
Do you drink that?
I drink wine, so
yeah.
But at the time, I was a complete teetotaler and just could not understand this idea that every Thursday
there was drink,
and Friday there was after work drink. Mm-hmm. Someone's leaving, someone's joining, someone's qualified. You know, there's always a reason to go and socialize, and that was new to me. Mm-hmm. And then also just the communication was so different. I didn't know what to make of the feedback people were giving me. It was always great, even when I knew it.
It wasn't great. Yeah. But was it a supportive environment? Did you feel like you were included, especially being from Africa? Mm-hmm. And probably one of the only black, seldom black faces in the office. How did you feel?
Yeah, I did feel welcome, to be honest. I felt, I was lucky because the partner that hired me was, Nigerian.
Oh, okay.
Kem Ihenacho, who's now a Latham, and he was a very well-loved, well-regarded partner at CC at the time, and he completely embraced me. And, I really believe in kind of setting the tone from the top. And because he embraced me, he believed in me, everyone else just followed. So I was lucky in that respect. And even when I was seconded to TMT, which is now called Tech and Digital, the partner at the time, Daniel Sandelson, was also very welcoming, very empowering, and then I just felt that everybody else just followed.
So you joined as an associate.
Yes.
Then
yes.
You were, I guess, a senior associate at some point.
Yes.
And then into the partnership. It can't be underestimated how much you probably have fought for your place in CC. What has that fight looked like?
I won't even lie. It's tough. My friends will be familiar with. I say blood, sweat, and tears.
Yeah.
Quite often, but it is a worthwhile fight, and it's a fight that involves, to be honest, just bringing you the best version of yourself to work every day. And if you're doing that, then it doesn't feel as daunting. Always dealing with perception. And I don't think this is just a question of, being black or being a woman. Everywhere you go, people already have a preconceived idea of what they want. And if you're lucky, you fit that perception, but the majority of us are not. And so you're constantly having to, demonstrate that, I can do this and I can do this well. But I often tell people actually that if, as a black person, you've entered those revolving doors either as a trainee, that probably means you're excellent.
Yeah.
And therefore you just need to show up every day and do your best.
Absolutely. I guess the other question is, what makes you tick? If you have to bring the best version of yourself to work, mm-hmm. Not everyone can do that every day. Mm-hmm. There are things that are stressful in personal life, etc. How have you managed to make that not a reality for you so that you can get ahead in your career?
So I'll just start by confessing that I too have those days when I don't feel like I'm ticking. I don't feel motivated. I have to push myself. I think it's just the recognition that, number one, it's a marathon, not a sprint. There's no particular destination that you will get to and you feel, okay, now I've now arrived, I've now succeeded. You'll get there, and there will be another challenge to overcome. And so for me, just pacing myself and recognizing that it's actually, and I know this is probably very bad advice, but it's actually never that serious. Eh? Don't take yourself too seriously. Just go in there, do your best. But also recognize that it's a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like people who say it's never that serious have already reached the pinnacle of seriousness, and therefore for them it's never that serious. But it is that serious for people who are really pushing and a senior associate in your shoes right now. Yeah. How did you make that leap? You want to be a partner in a law firm, probably at the top of your game. Mm. How do you make yourself stand out?
It's interesting that, and it's interesting to hear your perspective in terms of how serious it needs to be, because I think we pile on ourselves a lot of internal pressure and that can be counterproductive. And I think that's what I mean when I say it's never that serious. It's just, you know, recognize that, you know, first of all, if you're there, you have earned your right to be there. You deserve to be there. Otherwise, you would not be there, especially if you're a Black woman. If you're there, it's probably because you deserve to be there. So pace yourself, believe in yourself, right? And I think just do your best.
Yeah.
You know, no one can ever expect someone to do more than their best. And actually, if your best is not good enough, then you probably should be exploring other kind of alternatives. And in this day and age, there are plenty.
It's not like our time. My dad just suggested that I should be a lawyer, and that was it.
So when you're now co-head of Africa, you're in the TMT, you're dealing with clients on a daily basis. Even as a partner, do you still feel the pressure to show up and be the best that you can be? Or do you think, you know I'm good? Is there a certain comfort there?
So it's interesting because as a partner, I feel like the pressure shifts. Certainly for me, it shifted to I want to give my team the best experience. I want them to absolutely love coming in every day, get challenging work, get a platform where they can excel. So for me, the pressure is really, how do I do that? And how also do I instill that culture of excellence while still exciting these people?
And not diminishing them.
So on. So for me, the pressure, it's no longer about me proving that I'm excellent. I think it's really about me ensuring that every single member of my team feels that they can be excellent and they can see that path and they know how to be excellent.
Yeah.
And that's a different kind of pressure.
It is a different kind of pressure. And does people management come naturally to you? Are you a good leader?
I would say that I really enjoy the people aspect of my job. I really, really do. I love seeing people thrive. I love seeing people bring out the best versions of themselves. And I love it when people say that they enjoy M&A, which certainly was not the case when I was establishing an M&A practice within a practice that wasn't.
Yeah.
M&A. A lot of the associates that and trainees that came in to the tech team were coming to do digital regulation, you know, commercial
transactions.
Not M&A.
They transaction too.
So it's been really rewarding now, you know, fast forward, you know, 6 years later when trainees and newly qualified are actually coming to the digital thing. Yeah. I want to do tech M&A. That's been really rewarding.
What has been the career highlight so far?
I've had many. I think making partner was a big one for me.
How did you celebrate?
A few months in, some friends of mine managed to convince me to get a few friends together for a little party. So we had a party in London, which was quite nice. And it was all my closest friends.
Oh, that's nice.
Mm-hmm. You know, some of my friends came from Kenya, you know, for it. That was nice.
Okay.
That was nice. But it took me a while to actually recognize that I ought to celebrate this. And I came home. Actually, I found out I was going to make partner in Kigali attending the Africa CEO.
Oh, so just the one that we did. Oh, wow.
Back in 2019. Okay. That's when I got a call from, you know, our head of corporate to say that I had, you know, I was going to become partner. And I was so happy. And I went with my one of my other partners. We were, we had planned to go and see my mom in Kilifi. And my friend, his name is Gerard. He's a partner in our funds team. We went to visit my mom, and I brought this news to my mom, and my mom was like, "Okay, well done, Jen." She moved on. She moved on with her knife.
Yeah,
she didn't. Like the typical English teacher.
I love that.
Yeah,
I love that. Was the process? Is it a rigorous process to become a partner?
It is probably the most rigorous.
What does it involve?
Well, it involves. So you go through. So there's a whole business case assessment. There's a lot of. You know, it's a bit like, I feel like sometimes it's a bit like an M&A transaction, a lot of due diligence, really interrogating that business case
Is it, you know, have you built a sustainable business case that fits within the firm's
what was your business case?
So my business case was that I was going to establish a tech M&A practice.
Okay.
So that's doing M&A specifically for TMT sector players.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And at the time, you know, we were experiencing a significant uptick in activity in the sector. The sector was undergoing a lot of transformation.
Yeah.
Technology itself was beginning to really leapfrog various, you know, aspects and markets and businesses. And so I saw a real opportunity to develop a niche. But the other part of my business case was also helping grow our Africa.
Yeah.
Our Africa practice. And so, yeah, so the process involves interrogating that business case, and then you get into an interview process that's now about your individual skills. Are you the right candidate for this business case? And that is really rigorous.
So from other partners?
Yeah, we have a partnership selection group.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That interviews the candidates. And then if you're successful in that, then you go through a assessment center, which runs over 2 days, which is intended to test all your sort of business skills and
like actual test.
Yeah. So you have role play, have written exercises in a very intense sort of exam environment.
Gosh.
With the many, many assessors. In fact, I remember during my time, there's probably over like 70 or 80 assessors from across our different offices. It really is quite rigorous. It's very daunting, but I came out of it feeling that it's really rigorous and fair.
Okay,
I would say.
And then it's a pass or fail, I guess, for the assessment center.
Short answer to that is yes.
Yeah.
But I would say because it's almost the last stage in the process, it's actually most people pass.
Okay.
But I think, you know, the preparation for it and the experience of it really sets you up, I think, for life as a partner in the firm. Yeah.
Is it tough being a partner in the firm?
I wouldn't describe it as tough. I haven't found the job of being a partner tough. I've actually really enjoyed it. The first 3 years were very tough. And actually, I remember my mentors were advising me that it's the toughest time because you're establishing your practice, you're building a team, you're building your credibility in the market, etc. So I don't find the actual job tough, but I've always said to people, and I still do, that, you know, the higher you go, the hotter it becomes. Mm-hmm. I think most people, most lawyers underestimate the role of, you know, stakeholder management, also known as politics, in a partnership environment. And I think that that becomes the real learning curve, you know, learning how to, you know, work with people, manage stakeholders, build consensus. You know, in a partnership, you know, we're not in a corporate where someone tells you do this and you do it. You have to build consensus in almost everything you do.
Mm.
And I think that can be really, really challenging.
What is the toughest aspect of the politics? Is it aligning people or getting aligned?
We're human beings, right? And we bring, you know, I think we try hard to come to work and do our jobs, but we still, you know, and we still bring ourselves to work, and actually we encourage that.
Yeah.
Don't put on a mask and come to work. And I think whilst we celebrate all of that, we also need to recognize that also means sometimes people will bring then not so undesirable aspects to work, and we need to create the space to be able to work with that. And I think
Aline, you're saying a lot while not saying a lot. But I get it. I get it. People bring their biases, people bring their prejudices, people bring their preconceptions, I guess.
Absolutely. And it's not necessarily, you know, personal or targeted. It's just we bring ourselves to work and you know, your background, your conditioning, all of that. And that's actually what diversity means. It's not just the good stuff.
It's also the bad stuff.
It's the bad stuff as well. And so we need to create the space to be able to manage that, which also, remember at the start of the conversation, I said that I realized I fear conflict. I have learned that conflict can be a good thing. I have learned, I've had to learn how to navigate conflict.
Yeah.
In a way that is productive, in a way that is meaningful.
Yeah.
Not just for myself, but for the partnership, right?
Yeah. How do you stay credible within that environment? What is your center?
I think you have to keep learning. I mean, I decided that my niche was TMT.
Yeah.
So I really try to keep up with the industry. I go to industry conferences. It's interesting, actually, conferences, because most lawyers go to conferences to network. I actually like going to sit in
and learn,
to really learn from the industry players in terms of what they're thinking about, in terms of their strategy, the challenges, etc. I find that I learn a lot from just following my clients, following the industry, and then trying to put my lens as a lawyer to kind of think about what issues they might be facing and then talk about them. So establishing myself as a thought leader.
Yeah.
So within our sector group, I have spent a lot of time just learning. And I think in doing so, I remain relevant to my clients and then I remain credible.
Actually, Sammy said that one of the things that he really respects about you is your constant learning. So I think that is exactly echoing what he said. I wanted to get onto your day-to-day role and how you approach the work so that we can get to see the inside of Jennifer's brain.
Mm-hmm.
You have a new client. It's an M&A transaction. It's an M&A transaction TMT. What is the first thing that you're looking for? What is the first thing that you target with the client to make sure that you're on the same page?
So it starts with understanding why they're doing the deal.
Yeah.
Why are you acquiring this asset? Why this asset? What do you actually think you're buying?
Yeah.
So in the tech space, it's actually quite interesting because sometimes clients will come and say, oh, we really love this technology. You know, that we're buying this technology is super interesting for us and we can integrate it into our business, etc. And then you have a conversation with them and you interrogate things a little bit and you realize actually it's not the technology, it's the people that are building that technology. So for me, it starts with asking a lot of questions to just get underneath the client's thinking about what do they think they're buying and why are they buying it. And then that really helps us shape how we're going to assess the opportunity for the client. In the tech space, you know, we do occasionally get mega deals.
Yeah.
But quite often we're also dealing with growth businesses.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, management time is very precious because you're busy growing the business. You have to be very focused in terms of, you know, how you use their time in diligence.
Yeah.
You have to be conscious of that. And therefore, you know, having these very early conversations with the client, but also the target, that helps you scope out your diligence and quite early on recognize the issues that will determine the economics of the deal.
Yeah.
And that conversation, I think, has to be an ongoing conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, this idea of going and looking yourself in the data room, trying to figure things out for yourself, I think that sometimes can be counterproductive because you might be going down the wrong path. You know, having constant conversations with the client and the target as issues come up, I find super helpful.
No, that's a very good point. In terms of the ways of working, mm-hmm. what is the thing that you do, or maybe CC does, Clifford Chance does, that makes you very efficient with your clients or managing the relationship better? What is the kind of things that you guys do?
So I think constantly innovating, and I know that sounds sounds almost like cliche, but today we're talking very much about AI use cases and testing out AI use cases.
Yeah.
We were the first law firm to enter into a partnership with Microsoft and OpenAI, and they have been working with our data over several months now, and we're beginning to see some very interesting use cases. But when I think about, you know, 5 years ago, you know, any new technology that was coming through, we were keen to implement. You know, I remember we even tried, you know, setting up our own kind of legal tech unit.
Yeah,
would develop its own legal tech product. So I think that that idea that we must constantly find ways to make things more efficient for our clients, and making, you know, making that part of our culture, and we're we're also assessed on the same basis. So all of our associates have KPIs that include what we could best delivery objectives.
Yeah.
How are you doing your work more efficiently, or what
initiatives? Like best delivery.
Best delivery. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And what is your best delivery?
After having said all of that about technology, I think my best delivery is still my team.
Yeah.
You know, we sell, I say to my team that we sell IP, and our IP is the knowledge that we have. When you do a deal or when you give a piece of advice, capture that in a way that someone else will be able to use it. In, you know, and that with time, you build that knowledge base, you build that data bank that ensures that, I mean, it sounds very obvious, but it's amazing how someone will do a deal and then they move to the next one and you're reinventing the wheel. And lawyers just like, I don't know, maybe we just love doing it, but actually there's a lot more efficiency that we can get ourselves before we've even started deploying AI and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, having a post-completion analysis is helpful for that kind of thing. In terms of, like, if you are at the cusp of TMT and tech and, you know, maybe startups that are very innovative but don't have the cash flows yet, are you able to access that kind of transaction, or are you only looking at mega deals? You know, the ones that are more innovative, maybe the startup, the unicorn that is not yet been invested into.
You know, you raise a really good point. I think as lawyers, I mean, that's certainly one thing I've learned, is you can't be everything to everyone, right? You have to find your niche. You need to find the area where you can add most value. And so your practice needs to be relevant to your business model. So within the tech space, really, we're best suited for the mega deals. But equally in the sort of, you know, startup and growth phase, we have clients that are putting money in those businesses. So we do a lot of investor side work for our clients. We're investing in that space. And then in terms of company side work, we're looking at companies that are backed by our corporate clients, because, again, you know, you're helping. So if you take a bank, for example, that has a ventures arm, you know, advising that ventures arm enables us to really add value to the client, because we understand the regulatory issues, the compliance issues, and how those then play out within the startup space. Mm. And so therefore we're able to add value in that case, whereas I would struggle sometimes to see what value me as a, you know, Clifford Chance lawyer would add to a, you know, a business that's just starting out, that's kind of doing their pre-seed funding. I would struggle to see what value I'm adding in that space. Okay. And I think it's really so much about value, because, you know, clients want to pay for value.
Okay.
Yeah.
Understood. Okay. So now let's talk about, and this is a very, you know, emotive subject for me, which we've had a discussion on it already.
Mm.
Local counsel.
Yes.
Yeah. I really reject the idea of being local counsel, but anyway, it's the reality as we evolve.
I reject it too.
You do?
Yeah. Remember, I was once that local counsel.
Yeah, you were that local counsel. And I was international counsel.
Yeah.
And, you know, instructing local counsel. I've been on both sides.
Yeah.
Can we talk about, like, what, when you're working with local counsel, what is the thing that distinguishes, because I know everyone will want to know, distinguishes local counsel to make them definitely the go-to person for Clifford Chance, or, you know, definitely the go-to person for you and your team? And what can we do to improve and better our services? And what have you seen that you think can be ameliorated?
That's a very good question. I think that, you know, I talked about adding value.
Yeah.
I think it's really about that. And I think, I mean, let's use local counsel for purposes of this conversation, because I don't like that
term. The word, yeah. Can we change it?
I use in my case, if I'm working on a deal where I'm working with counsel in Kenya, I'll just say
Kenyan counsel.
In the same way I'm doing a deal in Norway at the moment.
Norway counsel. Let's do that. Yeah. Okay, fine. Uh-huh.
I mean, it's just it's descriptive, right? Understood. And I also wonder what local means in a context where if you've got a deal where the assets
is in the local jurisdiction. Exactly.
What do you actually mean? So anyway, coming back to your question, I think recognizing that.
Yeah.
Recognizing that actually this asset is in my jurisdiction. I know this asset. I should know this asset better than anybody else.
Correct.
Or certainly better than someone coming outside of that jurisdiction. Correct. I understand the issues. I understand the regulatory environment. I understand the political environment. I understand the macros. I understand all of that better than someone looking external in. I think being able to capture that value and express it quite early on in the transaction, okay, I think is super important. You know, when you have that first call, when you have that first call with a client, being able to offer unique insights that only you can bring,
yeah,
will have an impact on the client.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in the time I've been at CCA, our model, whenever we're working on transactions in Africa, is whenever we get an instruction. I mean, my latest one was a Nigerian deal where I sat with my Nigerian counterparts and said, here's the scope. Let's figure out where you guys can add value and where us guys can add value.
Yeah, yeah.
I would rather do 10% of the work where I'm adding value that the client is prepared to pay my premium rates than do 100% of the work where I'm not adding value and the client is challenging every single additional hour.
Correct.
I'm adding there. You know, then I'd rather have 10% of profitable revenues than 100% of unprofitable revenues. And I think so that's my own philosophy as Jen, and that's what we as a firm try to focus on, the areas where we can really add value. And so bringing that back to, in this case, Kenyan Council, it's recognize that you have value to add,
yeah,
and bring that value to the table.
Yeah. Can we talk tangible things, yeah, you know, aside from unique insights and,
yeah,
having that discussion early,
yeah,
on?
Yeah.
Is there ways of working,
yeah,
that I can add value more than others? So, for example, is it a checklist? Is it sending minutes of meetings? What is the thing that really cements that position as the unique, you know, value offerer for Kenyan Council?
Mm. So,
is it speed, which we need to also talk about as well?
We can talk about the speed, yeah, because sometimes speed isn't always the right thing, and I think the tech industry,
yeah,
the startup industry and the tech industry have learned that lesson the hard way. I think, very honestly, when you get onto a deal as Kenyan Council, try to match the level of service that is being offered. And by level, I'm talking about access, you know, accessibility, responsiveness, speed. I mean, we have technology now. We don't have an excuse for being slower than, you know, our international counterparts, right? So I think matching the level of service that's being provided is key. You know, quality of documentation. What's there to stop us from producing the same quality?
No.
There's nothing.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let's not make excuses. We have technology, we have the brains, we have everything. So just match what your international counterparts are putting on the table.
Yeah. I can see that being true for a lot of larger law firms within the Kenyan context, who do get those international instructions.
Mm-hmm.
For other counsel, it's important for us, I guess, training and, you know, giving back. I know you guys do the Clifford Chance Academy.
Mm-hmm.
How does that run? And explain that for people who don't know.
So the Clifford Chance Academy is an idea that we came up with about, gosh, maybe 10 or so years ago, where, you know, we recognize that in order for us to deliver a seamless service for our clients in this market, it was important that we try to share insights and knowledge with our partners, our delivery partners.
Yeah.
And therefore, the Academy is really a program that is targeted at associates in our partner firms across Africa. And our partner firms will tell us what areas they feel that they could benefit from that knowledge sharing, and will come into. And they're in-person,
yeah,
training programs. I think we've held one here.
Last year.
During the Africa Energy Forum. And, you know, we'll sit together for a whole day, sometimes even 2 days, and really get under the bonnet of, you know, certain, you know, practice areas or products. And over the last 10 years, I think we've had more than 500 associates. I mean, it's been super successful. But I think that's a really useful way to create win-win situations. So if you're, you know, Kenyan Council consistently tapping into those resources, I think can really help build that. But also enables us to learn about what's happening in the market, how people are doing things differently. You know, some of these products that we sell in Europe, for example, in the US, are not necessarily the right products.
Yeah.
For African markets. And, you know, private equity is a really good example where there's an ongoing debate as to whether they, you know, the typical US private equity model is suited for the African market. You know, we need to add our voice to that conversation. If that's not the model that's well suited, are there alternative models?
Yeah.
You know, we have all of these very, very unique insights that we can share.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the future and where tech is going. Mm-hmm. We just came back from the Africa CEO Forum.
Yes.
What were your key takeaways from that in terms of tech?
In terms of tech?
Yeah.
I don't know if you listened to the BCG presentation.
Yes, I did.
Tofik's presentation. One of the things he talked about was generative AI. I mean, it's the buzz. But when you think about the impact it can have in a market that still has real problems to solve, you know, the possibilities are endless. I also attended a session that, a panel session where there's a lady that left, she was working for big tech and left and has set up her own sort of, you know, data, you know, she's very much into kind of, you know, data mining, you know, tools that, allow, you know, businesses to do the, you know, data crunching in a meaningful way. And, you know, and her view is that despite the advancements in other markets, the fact that we have real problems to solve means that there is the opportunity for us to really come up with use cases. And so I'm very excited about the AI opportunity and also, you know, the demographics, you know, it's no surprise that, you know, big tech is looking at Africa in a big way, but we need to contribute not just as consumers of AI, but we need to also create our own AI system. So I just...
Yeah, so the conversation on being left behind, if we don't create our own, even in a language that is understood by, you know, the population, then, you know, that is quite worrying.
Yes. And there's absolutely, I honestly don't see any reason why we cannot be, you know, meaningful contributors to the AI opportunity. And I really think that our governments have a really important role to play in catalyzing that, making sure there's an enabling environment. And we've had really good success stories with M-Pesa. You know, the regulatory approach to M-Pesa is what has enabled M-Pesa to thrive. And, you know, we can do that with AI.
And bypassed generations of, you know, checkbook holders. So, you know, there's an opportunity to really bypass a lot of things if you use it in the right way.
Yes.
For Africa specifically, as co-head of Africa, what are you looking forward to? Let's talk positives forward to in 2024 and the types of transactions you're doing and what you're seeing is exciting in Africa.
Yeah.
And also your role in that.
So when I look at the African market, I see a number of global themes that are presenting opportunities, right? And before we even get to the global themes, that's the geopolitics. You know, the new world order is increasingly fragmented and creating a lot of complexity. And
who are you aligning yourself with?
Me as Jen? No,
who are we aligning ourselves with?
Yeah. I think who are we as Africa?
Africa.
Yeah. So it's presenting that opportunity for Africa to really play a meaningful role. I mean, back to the CEO forum where, you know, we were asked the question, you know, are we going to be at the table or on the menu? And I really love what the business leader said, and Ralph Mopita of MTN said that why didn't we just create our own
table?
I really like that idea. And so when I look at Africa, the Africa that's creating its own table, I said it presented a lot of opportunities for our Africa business. By the way, our Africa business is increasingly very African.
Really?
Because you can tell, I mean, Danny got promoted.
Yes, days. Danny, congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations. Yeah. Congratulations, Danny Mustafa, my co-hands, yeah. Moroccan. We have Owens, who's Moroccan. We have Kayode and Olamide, who are Nigerians. Like, we have a really strong coverage of homegrown African lawyers.
Yeah. And Mayowa.
And Mayo,
shout out to
Mayo. I mean, that would be, yes. Shout out to Mayo and Uni and Chris.
Chris was my trainee, so yeah.
And Albert Swanika and my team, yeah, was Ghanaian. Our AI guru, yeah, is Ghanaian. So you know, it's exciting for me to see this emerging crop of, you know, legal industry leaders that are African and that are operating in the African,
yeah,
marketplace.
Yeah.
And I think it is important to gain, you know, the full range of skills, but really find a way to make those skills relevant,
yeah,
for our continent. So that excites me for the firm, but it also excites me as an individual,
yeah,
that there is a role that I can play.
There is a, yeah, angel. When you look at what do you want Jennifer to be known for? I mean, aside from obviously already being a legend, what will your legacy be? What do you want it to be?
That's a good question. I mean, I would like to be remembered for having, you know, supported transactions that have a real impact on our continent, on people's lives. But more importantly, actually above everything else, if I can just be remembered for having empowered someone to start the legal career as I did and then grow to find their own niche and be, you know, create their own version of success and, you know, have fulfilled careers. I think that, to me, if I have individuals that say Jen played a role in my development, that would make
me. I'm sure there are many, many, many women out there who are saying that already. So I think you've achieved that. Let's do a very quick tips and tricks for working well.
Okay.
So this is just about work so that we can get it. What advice would you give to anyone looking to get into legal practice?
Oh, gosh, I think I said it before. Recognize that it's a marathon, not a sprint. You will be exhausted if you sprint this, you know, this race. You know, come in, you know, learn every day and don't. Just put the anxiety to one side and recognize that it's a marathon, not a sprint.
If you're a trainee at the moment, how can you stand out to a partner, senior associate, to make sure that, you know, they're seeing you?
Oh, I would say there is so much for all of us to learn now, especially with all the developments in digital regulation, which impact all sectors. So this is not just for trainees that are looking to be tech lawyers. I think learning what is happening out there and bringing it, being the first person to bring it to your colleagues to say, you know, have you read about this? And it doesn't have to even be a legal development. It can just be, client X published the annual results today. This is what, you know, these were the takeaways. Just be that person.
Because partners don't have the time to do that necessarily. So maybe, yeah, you can do that.
Yeah.
How do you deal with a down day?
I think, first of all, be kind. You mean down day that you're feeling down or
yes? No, that was good.
That okay. Down that you're feeling down.
Down and busy at the same time.
Okay, so no. So the down one, in terms of if you're feeling down, my biggest piece of advice is be kind to yourself. Recognize that we all have them, and it's okay to have down days. Just pick yourself up. Don't stay down. Be kind to yourself. And pick yourself up. And different people have different ways to pick themselves up. Sometimes it's speaking to a friend. Sometimes it's music. Sometimes it's actually taking some time out. That is all okay.
Yeah.
Be kind.
We talked about mentorship, and you have mentors. Is it mentors within the firm or
both?
I have
mentors both within the firm, outside, yeah, the firm. I have mentors of all ages from my 11-year-old
reverse to mentors,
my
then
70-year-old. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. We need it to be both ways. I learned so much,
yeah,
from my 11-year-old niece. And I learned so much from my friends who are in their, you know, late 60s.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to ask you, if I was to say Jennifer has this skill and is not learning and is not a passion for learning or for enthusiasm, what is the key skill that you think you possess as a partner?
Just one.
Yeah. That's the top one. The one that you think is the one that makes you Jennifer.
I think curiosity.
Yeah.
I ask a lot of questions. I ask questions. I don't fear asking stupid questions. I just ask questions. And that really enables me to not only learn, but to build. It really enables me to build relationships.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you get away? I mean, that is a very key skill. I certainly would be fearful of looking stupid. How do you make sure that you don't really get or you don't feel fear?
No. I have been in situations where in an entire boardroom I've asked, oh, what's this? And people looked at me like, how can you not know?
Yeah.
What this is. I think if you're in this business, you know, in lingerie, when you're, maybe it's because I am a weird person in the typical boardroom. I'm already
standing out
in some ways,
yeah.
And I'm already having to challenge perceptions. And you know, when you've gone through that kind of second guessing yourself all the time, should I speak? And then one day you realize whether you speak or not, people will have whatever perceptions they have about you. Maybe it's that, but I really genuinely have developed a just confidence to ask questions. If I don't understand something, I ask.
I love that. And again, yeah. The minute you open your mouth, especially in that kind of setting, mm-hmm. the better, the more confident you feel once you've asked the first question. But if you don't, then you're locked in.
Yeah, and also I've realized that in those environments, most people are coming there to talk.
Yeah.
They already have their, this is the point I'm going to make, etc. And therefore, in fact, quite often the judgment is not as harsh as you think it is because everyone is coming up out of there thinking, did I make my point well? How did I come across?
Yeah.
Etc. They're not busy thinking, what kind of question was that you asked?
Yeah.
Well, okay. Yeah.
Well, it's been an education. Thank you so much, Jennifer. I'm going to ask you, we do the quick fire round.
Oh, so I thought that was the quick fire.
No.
Okay. So what does the quick fire work?
Well, you're not supposed to have looked at the questions, so yes. I hope you didn't.
No,
but it's just very quick questions. First, if it comes into your head, answer.
One word answers or?
Oh, you could be more than.
Can be more than one.
And beach or city holiday?
Beach.
Where?
Kigilithi.
Favorite place to visit?
Favorite place to visit? Oh.
In your off days, on your leave days, do you actually take annual leave? Do you think
of course I do. I take a lot of annual leave. Yeah. Listen, I'm becoming a fan of South Africa, actually.
Where?
You know, I've been to places. Recently, I went to Drakensberg.
Someone else told you. Wasn't you thinking about Drakensberg?
No, it wasn't.
But
you know, even the garden route is absolutely beautiful. But it's because it's a recent thing for me, and I want to explore South Africa.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Apples or oranges?
Oranges.
Why?
Actually, very cheap. My dad has a pixie orchard, right?
Oh, really?
They are the most delicious things you've eaten. Definitely oranges, pixie oranges.
Pizza topping of choice? I don't like pizza.
No, I don't like pizza. I do like, I don't think I have a favorite topping, but I do love vegetarian pizza.
Oh, okay.
I do.
Well, nice. I think vegetables, yeah.
Yeah.
Favorite drink?
Favorite drink? Actually, you know what? Kenyan coffee. I am such a fan. Kenyan coffee, filter coffee. My husband makes it every morning.
Always. Oh, nice.
Just, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
We didn't even get on to the husband, but we'll keep that for another time.
For another time.
Jennifer, thank you so much. You are such an inspiration to a lot of women. And I know that this is a very important conversation for a lot of women who can't get hold of you. So I'm very privileged. Thank you
Jerry. So are you. I absolutely love your podcast. It's an honor being here. You are doing, this is incredible.
Thank you.
Just opening up these spaces and, you know, giving people a sneak preview into what, you know, the life of a lawyer looks like. I'm so proud of what you guys have achieved.
Thank you so much.
You know, Ndolo, I used to share an office with Ndolo and you know, and you guys are just...
I think there's a mutual respect there. So thank you so much, Jennifer. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
See you guys next month. Thank you very much.
Bye.